And it wouldn't go through the normal hearing.
Would not have any rate hearings and would be based upon a specialized, particular formula. And the formula contains five or six different factors related to different costs. And there are three different, there's your basic line charts, then there's some additional, there were three categories of rates and five, I believe, factors in the formula for determining what the rate increase would be. Within those, there are caps. We had a long explanation of it, and it might be valuable to have someone from the commission go through the specifics of the formula, but there is a set formula, and within that there were caps on how much something could increase. And I can give you an example of one factor in the formula is the difference between the rate, current rate, and the costs. Just for an example, let's say we use this 2780 figure, and let's say the rate is 16. So there's about a $10 difference there. The rate couldn't go up any year any more than 5% of that difference in any one year, and there's a $2 cap on the year as well. Those are the kinds of things that are in the formula.
Thank you. A bit complicated.
Anyone else have any questions of Representative Vikas? Everybody afraid to get into this too deeply, or
they know I can't answer.
Sure, I will. You're going to save yours for later. All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ron. Our next witness is Pat Hickey of AT&T. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Hickey, and I represent AT&T in Oregon. Our responsibilities include legislative responsibilities, regulatory, and public relations for the state for AT&T. I want to explain a little bit the testimony that you have before you. Last year, we represented testimony to you that is still fairly much current in terms of how we operate in the state, and I attached a couple of pages on top of that, and that should suffice for a general overview of what we have done in the state. I want to say, first of all, that I've heard many witnesses here talk about how excited they are to testify before committee, and with AT&T's move to reduce personnel and all the rest of that in the recent past, you can't imagine how thrilled I am to be here today to do this for you.
We'll have the record specifically underlined.
Thank you, yes. Send it east for me, too, if you don't mind. I do want to just take a minute, it won't take too long, we're not really into the Universal Service Protection Plan social contract, but I wanted to take a few minutes to describe five relationships, put it in that kind of a situation for you, and you will hopefully at that time understand how AT&T operates and what some of our concerns are. First of all, the most important relationship we have in the state is with our customer, and I guess to the degree that we are a competitive company now, we are in a fragile relationship with the customer. We sell terminal equipment, much like your GTE system that you have here, that is in competition with every innumerable companies providing similar equipment, PBXs, telephones, computers, and the like. Also, we provide long distance in the state. We are among about 19 different carriers who are registered and or operating in the state to provide long distance services. Basically, we offer inter-LATA, and I hate to get into that term, but we offer calling between the two zones that were decided by the Department of Justice for which people could call in the state. If we had all the traffic between those two zones in the state, just to give you an idea, we would have 35% of all of the long distance within the state. I'm just talking about within Oregon. So that's the level of our the size of our long-distance market, I guess you could, as you could call it, in the state. We do not provide any local exchange service. We reach our customers only through the local exchange carriers, example, PNB, General Telephone, and independent companies. Our relationship, basically our customer then has a decision to make about whether they want AT&T or not, and do have alternatives at their disposal to make that choice. The next relationship I want to talk about was our relationship with local exchange carriers. That is Pacific Northwest, Bell, General Telephone, United, and so on. We are a purchaser, we are a customer of theirs, one of their largest customers. We purchase access to your business or your home through those companies. We cannot reach you or other customers without going through the local company. We, in a sense, then, are a buyer and they are a supplier. Also, we are in competition with the local companies. Example, the long-distance networks that PNB can establish or other companies can establish are in competition with ours. Also, some Centrex services that are provided by the local companies are in competition with some of our more sophisticated PBXs. So we do have a kind of an interesting relationship with those people, and one that is growing by the day, more complicated, as I'm sure you can well imagine. Thirdly, our relationship with competitors is exactly as it should be in some sense. That is that we have competition in the state for all of our services. The difference between us and our competitors, in addition to the type and price of our service, is the fact that in some areas they can operate a little differently in that they have no regulatory constraints over their activities where we do. An example of that is that we are obligated to provide service in certain areas and they are not obligated to provide service in certain areas. They do still have pricing advantages in terms of access purchasing and all the rest of that, but basically we are able, because of the Commission's activity, to operate in a pretty competitive market with them. The fourth relationship we have, and I'll get into the governmental end of it, is with the PUC. House Bill 2200 provided the PUC with the ability to have an administrative rule procedure called AR-131. In that, AT&T was designated the status of an inter-exchange public utility. It was a creation of that particular hearing process. It provided us the ability to have some pricing flexibility in our long-distance services, which are the only services that we have are regulated. It was, in a sense, a good move in that we were able to reduce prices, offer new services as we see fit in the state, and there are some constraints that obviously maintain for us a position with our customers where we cannot raise our rates beyond a certain rate, have to provide service, and have service restrictions or constrictions under which we have to live. It is a good plan for the moment and provides us the ability to work with our customers in a competitive environment until we can become more like our competitors in the regulatory sense. Lastly, I would say our relationship with the legislature, let me state it through House Bill 2200. We felt House Bill 2200 was a very good bill for our needs. And by our needs, I mean that of the long-distance carrier industry. It provided the industry with the ability to classify carriers as competitive, as inter-exchange public utilities, and gave us the ability to really operate in the market in the state. In that sense, it was excellent. From that viewpoint, we would like to see House Bill 2200 left alone in terms of how it treats long-distance competition, toll competition, if you want to call it that. Our interest in social contract, universal service protection, is that the services that come under the guidelines that would be established by universal service protection are the local services and some of the discretionary services that are provided. We would hope to have those priced so that, one, people do stay on the network, because as more people stay on the network, we hope that long distance usage increases, and that helps everybody in the industry. And two, that there is a plan that provides the local company the strength to maintain good access to us. That's very important because, as again, we cannot get to the customer without their help. Basically, those are the five relationships that I wanted to talk about. Just take a few minutes of your time. I know I'm supposed to say that I'm very happy to answer questions, because I've heard a lot of people say that, and I am, if you have any. I'm rather new at this, so you have to excuse if I don't get all the terminology right.
Well, there isn't very much terminology in this business.
Well, you have the book on the telephone terminology, so you probably know more now about it than I do.
Any questions of the witness? Representative Anderson.
I'm going to ask a dumb question.
You can expect a similar answer.
Truthful.
Does everyone who has local service have to have a long-distance carrier?
Let's put it this way. They can choose a carrier, Representative Anderson, but they don't have to use them because they don't have to make a long-distance call. I don't...
That isn't the question.
Excuse me.
The question is, do they have to select a carrier? Do they have to have a carrier at all?
Yes. Thank you for the clarification. Yes, they do. If they do not select, when they are given the opportunity, they are assigned a carrier based on a division or a determination of the market share that perhaps MCI has or AT&T has.
One follow-up. Is this because technology or the cost of avoidance of long-distance service is not feasible at this present time to isolate to local call only?
I don't know that that is the reason. I think the reason, if I understand your question right, was to give, if a person didn't select a carrier, it was to give everybody a chance, that is the other competitors, to have customers based on their market share. And I don't know exactly the answer if that was because we didn't have toll denial availability or not. It is existent, but it's not offered universally.
Mr.
Chair?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. I was going to say, if everybody is paying, whether they use long distance or not, everybody is paying an access fee. Access fee for long distance.
You, through their local rate, there is a formula and a rather complicated percentage or formula for establishing that. That's correct. As we and the other competitors in long distance industry pay a fee to use it, so does the local customer as well. It is a portion and a smaller portion of the total fee. That's correct.
Anyone else? Boy, you get off too lightly. I can't understand this.
That's pretty good. First time it should be.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
We were just discussing about whether a person had to have access to long distance company or not, and I guess this is the question that 2 years ago it seemed to be in most cases not technologically possible to limit telephone service. And when we're looking at low income ability now dial 911, and we're looking at telephone deposits could be drastically different if there was not access on a long liner or
that's
trying
correct.
To clear that up somewhere along
that's
the way.
Correct. You are right.
Good. Any other questions?
Let's draft a bill.
Thank you very much.
Let's draft a bill.
Next witness, Bob Gray of MCI.
We need to shake up some pitch. You did that a little bit. That's what you do to you right now.
Mr. Chairman, I have copies of a bill which MCI has submitted to the subcommittee, and it's my understanding that the bill has been or will be introduced at the request of MCI. I have copies with me if people would like to have that. I do not have extra copies of my prepared testimony at your pleasure.
I'm sorry, go ahead with that.
Would you like my question is, would you like copies of the draft bill that MCI has submitted to the testimony?
I think that Representative Ickes has already, we've already voted to sponsor that bill at your request, I believe.
Right.
In the right, Ron, you have copies of that bill. We don't need copies.
What's the LC number?
What's the LC number?
It was one of those 10 we did the other day.
Right. We do have it. Fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ickes, my name is Robert Gray. I am an attorney with Preston, Thorgrimson, Ellis, and Holman. Our business address is Suite 3200 of the U.S. Bancorp Tower, Portland, Oregon. I'm appearing today on behalf of MCI Telecommunications Corporation. As you know, MCI provides competitive long-distance or toll service, and MCI is certified by the Public Utility Commissioner as a competitive telecommunications provider. My testimony today has several purposes. First, it will present MCI's interpretation of HB 2200 and what we would expected, what we had expected would happen in the implementation process based on that interpretation. Second, we will discuss MCI's concerns about a number of loose ends in the statute that have become apparent during the implementation process. Third, I will discuss suggested changes to the statute. These amendments are largely housekeeping in nature, and they do not propose major changes in statutory direction, and as I've already mentioned, those changes are incorporated in a bill that's been introduced at the request of MCI in the subcommittee. At the time HB 2200 was adopted in 1985, MCI believed it was intended to work as follows. Telecommunication services, as defined in the statute, were to remain regulated until a showing was made that those services were subject to competition under the terms of the statute. Certain narrow exceptions were made for services specifically excluded from the statutory definition of telecommunication services, but these services were only exempt from regulation if provided by an entity not otherwise classified as a public utility. In other words, radio common carrier service, for example, would not be considered a telecommunication service if the entity providing that service was not a public utility. Entities which provided only competitive services or services for which there were reasonable alternatives were eligible for the classification as competitive providers, and that, as I mentioned, is the classification that MCI has achieved. The process of deregulating services or providers was to be done case by case based on evidence provided by the proponent of deregulation. The detariffing procedure was similar to deregulation, but the implications of detariffing are somewhat different, as you probably know. In the case of detariffing, the service remained subject to regulation and revenues were treated as utility revenues. However, the statute clearly provided that the services could only be detariffed on a case-by-case basis following a showing that the service met the required statutory tests, which were, of course, based on the existence of competition. And there was an additional phrase in the statute that discussed detariffing services that are considered to be non-essential, and that was the part of the crux of the USPP proposal. Following adoption of the legislation, a lengthy process began which resulted in the AR 131 rules. The lengthy implementation process resulted from the inherent complexity of the subject matter and the changing nature of the industry. As I will discuss in a moment, the lengthy process also resulted from several attempts to develop rules which simply were not contemplated, we don't believe, by HB 2200 and were based to some extent on certain ambiguities and unclear language in the statute. We believe that the AR 131 rules, which finally were adopted by the commissioner, largely carry out the statutory intent. The first attempt during the implementation process to what we consider to be stretch the legislation was an attempt by PNB to deregulate certain services by, quote, definition. In proposing this, PNB took the position that certain of its services were deregulated simply because they fell outside the narrow statutory definition of telecommunication services contained in the statute. The PNB position was contrary to what we believe were express statements made by PNB representatives during the legislative discussions on HB 2200, and the position suggesting deregulation by definition was ultimately rejected by the commissioner. The second effort to, again, stretch the legislation was an attempt to adopt the Universal Service Protection Plan. The USPP would have permitted massive detariffing of telecommunication services which were considered to be non-essential. Participating utilities would have been allowed to raise rates each year during the plan's term by preordained amounts, regardless of whether those rate increases were reasonable at the time they were to go into effect. And that, of course, is the crux of the discussion you had with Ron a moment ago. In proposing the USPP, the commissioner relied on a section of 2200 which permitted to act with discretion in overseeing telecommunications matters. He acknowledged that what he was proposing was not explicitly contemplated by the legislature at the time HB 2200 was enacted. Many of the many of the parties commenting on the HB, on the USPP proposal pointed out its many defects and that no clearly defined legislative authority existed to support implementation. After what we consider to be vociferous objection to the proposal by many parties, the USPP was put on a back burner to be considered later, presumably following the current legislative session. MCI believes these and other similar efforts to stretch the plain meaning of 2200 have seriously hampered its efficient implementation by diverting the energies of the commissioner's staff, the industry, and affected parties into efforts that did not further the express intent of the statute. MCI believes the potential of HB 2200, that there is substantial potential within 2200, that it is a workable piece of legislation, but that its true potential has not been achieved due to the diversionary efforts that I've described. We support the statute's overall theme of balancing regulation and competition. We believe the attempts to stretch legislative intent demonstrate that certain housekeeping amendments are needed. The housekeeping amendments, while limited in scope, will help ensure that HB 2200 is implemented consistent with the original statutory intent. And now I'd like to describe the eight or so amendments to the bill that MCI has requested be incorporated. The first amendment proposes a changed definition of telecommunications service, which would clarify that all aspects of transmission of telecommunications service are subject to regulation under the statute.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative Parker.
Is this LC 2367?
I don't know the number, but I have a copy of the bill.
What's your relating clause say?
Well, I have a copy of our draft that we submitted, so I don't have the relating clause.
I think.
I can quickly tell.
It is. Okay. I'm getting the head nods and bad copy.
What was the number?
Thank you.
As I mentioned, the First Amendment proposes a change definition.
Mr. Gray, let me ask, you had indicated earlier you had a copy. We had introduced this as a committee bill the other day. Does anyone feel that they need to have a copy of this to see the amendments?
This stage, I think.
All right.
How many were there?
If you feel more comfortable having a copy, well, I think we could make those. Yes, Representative Pearson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little confused. I presume you will be back when we're actually hearing the bill.
I'm prepared to do that as well. I'm prepared to discuss the legislation in any way that's convenient for the committee, of course.
Mr. Gray, I think what would be useful at this point, since we will, that bill has been introduced by the committee, I think at the request of MCI, is that not accurate, Representative Eakins? It will be introduced in the House. I assume that it will be coming back to this committee. Mm-hmm. My intent is that we'll go to the subcommittee chaired by Representative Eakins with members Representative Anderson and Representative Rocky Berea. They will then hold a hearing on it, and it will then at some point come back to this full committee because we'll have to take action on it before it comes out of the body. I think at this point what you might do is just give us a summation of those.
Okay.
So that at the point it's being considered by the subcommittee, it will have all the legislation and everything before it.
Okay. I will go through them in summary form. That's fine. And we're available, of course, to testify at your pleasure at any time.
Thank you.
The change definition in telecommunication services more broadly covers the field of telecommunications and makes clear that we are not trying to narrowly limit the definition to the two-way switched access and voice transport that's now included in the bill. There were a number of questions during the implementation process about what's in the definition and what's out of the definition. There are certain narrow exceptions that are contained in the bill right now. Those are fine. But we think the way the definition section operates needs to be clarified for the industry and for all affected parties. So that's what we're trying to do with the first change in the language. We have included one additional criteria in the criteria that determines whether a service or an entity is subject to competition. That is a criteria that relates to the number and size of alternative providers of the service. We've included that criteria because it's the traditional antitrust analysis of whether competition exists as we understand it. We have made certain housekeeping changes, consolidating certain sections that I don't need to go into. We have limited the ability to deregulate services in the case of local exchange services, which means simply that local exchange services would not be available for deregulation on the theory that those services are probably not competitive. We have consolidated the statutory tests for deregulation. We have suggested that two statutory tests that are placed in the alternative in the deregulation section, the subject to competition or in the public interest, be consolidated into one test. In simple terms, we don't know what it means to say because something is in the public interest, it should be deregulated. And we think that's a point that's problem waiting to arise in the future. Deletion of certain ambiguous authority of the commissioner. We believe that the USPP came into existence as a proposal and really got us off the track from the main thrust of HB 2200 because of certain sections in the existing 2200 which we believe are ambiguous to the detriment of the industry and all affected parties. We've suggested deleting those sections. Essential service language, one of the reasons why we got into the USPP again was because the detariffing section of HB 2200 includes a provision which permits the commissioner to detariff so-called essential or non-essential services. And we were never sure what that term meant and how it related to the existence of competition, although we thought the two ought to be construed the same because of the overall theme of 2200. To us, it makes most sense to delete that phrase in the detariffing section, get down to business with the existence of competition, and work from there. Toll services, the bill singles out toll services for certain special status, which is a little bit unclear under the bill. We've suggested deletion of that section. And then we have certain amendments to antitrust statutes, which simply make it clear that once a service or an entity is out of regulation by the commissioner, that entity or service is within the antitrust provisions. And that's a summary of the provisions. I'd be happy, as Pat would, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Do we have questions of the witness? No, thank you very much. I wonder if we could take a very brief recess. I need to call my other two members here for coming back in a couple of minutes. I'm trying to get the other two because I want to take action. Representative Anderson wants to be recorded on being on the Gorge bill. We need unanimous consent, so I need everybody here.
Oh, sure. I'll make a point of view.
Okay, so let's see if we can dig up the other two. I was planning to have a recess when we got through the telecommunications material today, too. So. Carol, will you go out and see if
see
if we can find our other two members?
Do they know who they are?
Ask your forbearance. I think Representative Anderson's out. Call.
Okay.
Sure. He was the one who was working there. Representative Anderson has requested that he be recorded in favor of the Gorge bill, House Bill 2472, that we voted out last Friday. And if he would like to make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would ask for unanimous consent committee to change my vote from nay to aye on House Bill 2472.
Is there any objection? If not, the record will show that Representative Anderson voted for the bill and the committee voted unanimously for House Bill 2472. Thank you. We'll continue then our hearing on the telecommunications informational material. At this point, I'll ask Jack Landau to. Now, that is, by the way, that doesn't mean that everybody's excused to just run off. This is fascinating material. So, isn't that never right?
It'll be good. That's all.
Yes, you have to go. You're excused.
I'm excused. I'll be right back. be right back. I really like.
Thank you.
Thank you. Here, I'll get you some.
All right, fine. Well, I, for the record, I wanted to be on good favor with Representative Ickes, since everybody was here last Friday and didn't get a chance to be heard, so he's a little irritated with me, but we want to move on with this topic. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Jack Landau. I'm an attorney with the Portland law firm of Lindsay Hart, Neal, and Weigler. I represent business customers of telecommunications services in Oregon, including a consortium or trade association that's known as Tracer. It's been so long, I can hardly remember what that means, but if I recall correctly, it's the Telephone Ratepayers Association for Cost-Based and Equitable Rates. What I would like to do this afternoon is briefly explain to you what Tracer is, who they are, what their interests are, and how you might see us in the coming months in this legislative session, so that you know where we fit into the larger picture here. Tracer is a trade association, as I said, of a number of Oregon businesses. They include such people as Boeing, First Interstate Bank, Nike, Precision Cast Parts, Weyerhaeuser, Fred Meyer, about 80 Oregon hospitals, a number of others as well. Over the last 4 years,